A new prize for every day of the drive. This is the one opportunity that you have to become a member on Health Watch. Get your name entered into the drawing, and if you become a member at a minimum $60 level, you can also pick up a copy of Dr. Weil's book, Mind Over Meds.
And $60? That's what, $5 a month?
$5 a
month.
That's
affordable.
It's very affordable.
Cheaper than cigarettes.
877-500-5266. Cheaper than cigarettes, better for you,
yep.
Better with you. Just remember that supporting KBOO is bringing strong medicine of information and critical thinking to your community. And so it's not just something that you do for yourself, it's something that you do for everybody listening. Now's the time. We can't mention it too many times. And just before we go, I want to say a quick thank you to Brittany from Salem.
Thank you, Brittany.
Who became a member online. And also Tasha from Happy Valley, who says, thanks for bringing us Democracy Now!, Health Watch, Between the Covers, and other great shows, and for being such a key space in the community.
Thank you, Tasha.
Way to go, Tasha. It's good to hear from Happy Valley. I think that's our first call from them today.
I love that name, Happy Valley.
Happy Valley.
Sort of so
Stepford Wivesian. Yeah. Salty. Anyway, we got to get going. But thanks so much for all of you who called. Thanks to all of you who are going to call, and do it now.
Welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, your show for voices of resistance and alternative news from the nation's capital. I'm Esther Averam. Well, now it's time for The F Word, our monthly segment that explores fascism, which we define as 1960s revolutionary George Jackson defined it, the complete control of the state by monopoly capital, when the relationship between the state or the government and corporations becomes indiscernible. And as we go deeper into the Trump administration of billionaires and corporatists turned policymakers, we're very pleased that our guest this month is the economist Richard D. Wolff, professor emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and currently a visiting professor at the New School University in New York City. He's author of several books, including Capitalism's Crisis Deepens, Essays on the Global Economic Meltdown. And he's also co-founder of the social justice organization Democracy at Work. Welcome to On the Ground, Professor Wolff.
Thank you. Very glad to be here.
Well, we took a break for this segment in August. And during that time, self-described fascists and neo-Nazis held violent and deadly protests in Charlottesville, Virginia. And those actions referenced the kind of evoke the fascism that emerged in Europe during the 1930s, which I think for most people defines fascism. We think of authoritarianism, violence, genocide, but I don't think that many of us know about the economic underpinnings of what happened in Europe in the 1930s. So I wonder if you can start by breaking down some of the economics of what happened then.
Sure, I'd be glad to. The similarity between now and then, and you're quite right about that, the similarity is that both then, and we're talking about the 10 years after 1929, the so-called Great Crash of capitalism that started in October 1929 and lasted for at least the next 10 years, that crash, like the one after 2008 that we're still living through, taught an awful lot of people that the capitalist economic system in which they were living was at best unstable and at worst capable of unspeakable suffering for millions and millions of people who had been led to believe that this was an economic system that only went in one direction, namely up for everybody, and here they were living in a situation where that obviously was not true. And what happened in the 1930s, as we had the breadlines and the suffering captured in American novels like The Grapes of Wrath or Of Mice and Men and many, many others, what you had in those days was a very different reaction from what you had here after 2008. And that was true not only in the United States, but in Germany, in Italy, all over the capitalist world, then as again now. What happened differently then was that the mass of working people decided that their best response to capitalism was to question it, to blame it, if you like, for what was happening to them, and to begin to seriously demand that capitalists either give way to a new and different system, socialism of one kind or another, or come up with big bucks to help people through the depression which their capitalist system had foisted on everybody. And so you had the emergence of very powerful left-wing capitalism-critical movements. In this country, they were associated with the CIO, the union movement, with the greatest union movement in American history, happened in the 1930s, bigger than anything that had happened before and bigger than anything that has happened since. And the unions were allied with two socialist parties and the Communist Party here in the United States. And very, very similar things happened in Germany, Italy, and so forth. The problem was that capitalists in different countries reacted differently. And here's where the fascism comes in. In the United States, for a whole host of reasons, the government at that time, Franklin Roosevelt, decided that the best way to handle the depression that he had been elected president into, and the pressure from the unions and socialists and communists from below, the best way was to kind of cut a deal, to give the mass of American people a New Deal. That's literally what they called it, the New Deal. And that included things like setting up Social Security, setting up the unemployment compensation system, passing the first minimum wage law that had ever been had in America, and then the biggest one, creating a government jobs program. So between 1934 and 41, the government created and filled 15 million jobs. A staggering program of taxing corporations and the rich, which is what he did, to raise the money to do these very expensive things, to give everybody over 65 a check every month for the rest of their lives, Social Security, to provide the millions of then unemployed people with unemployment checks every week for a year or two, and so on. In Germany and Italy, the reaction of capitalists to the rising demands of their own unions and workers, socialists and communists, was completely different. Their reaction economically, which I'm about to describe, is what we now call fascism, and what indeed they called fascism at the time. It was not to cut a deal with the pressure from below, but it was actually the opposite: to crush, to destroy, to repress all of those movements. So, for example, in the classic case of Germany, what Hitler did when he came to power in January of 1933, that's when he got there, 4 years into, or 3.5 years into the Depression, what he did was to literally arrest, and in many cases eventually kill in jail, communists, socialists, and all the rest. Yes, what we've heard about were the authoritarian ways he went about doing it. He outlawed other political parties. He basically made his own Nazi party the only effective political force in the country by, again, arresting, injuring, killing, as he needed along the way, to get that kind of power. But in economic terms, what it meant was that the government outlawed independent trade unions. The trade unions all now had to become part of the government party apparatus, the Nazi party that took over. No other unions could be allowed. As I said, the communist and socialist parties were repressed. You were arrested if you were part of that. You could be drafted into the army. You could eventually later be killed. Now, all of it was justified on the grounds that Germany had to defend itself against the world. Nobody was attacking Germany, so this was a little bit crazy, but it's the kind of feelings in the society that were revved up by this. You had to protect Germany from Jews. You had to protect Germany from communists and socialists. And in the name of protecting against all these alleged evils, what Hitler did was really deliver the economy over to big business. He basically destroyed all the critics of big business, all the critics of capitalism were removed, and the society was reorganized so that you had the big businesses who stayed in power, the same VW, the same Siemens, the same Krupp, all the great families of industrial capitalism in Germany held on to their businesses, but what they had was the government as their absolute enforcer. The government meant that there would be no union that they would have to worry about, that there would be no criticism of anything they did that they had to worry about. The government became organized political thug, hired, if you like, by big business to build the economy around exclusively what they wanted and what they needed. And that's what fascism, economically speaking, that's what it is. It's when you merge the government and big business in such a way that the government becomes the enforcer of a society of, by, and for the profits of the biggest businesses.
You know, recently when you broached this subject of fascism on your show, Economic Update, which I should tell listeners is syndicated around the country and began at our sister station, WBAI in New York, you laid out an economic definition of fascism that is similar to what we use for this segment. But then you said you would leave it up to listeners to decide if the United States either it is or heading in the direction of fascism. So I'd like to turn that question back to you and ask you to talk about the way that capitalism is or is not turning into fascism in the United States.
Yeah, you know, that's fair enough. You have every right to do that, and I think it's actually a great idea. So let me try to go a little further than I felt it was safe to go on my own show as you picked it up. And you picked it up exactly right. Here's what I would say. The reason we're not yet in a fascist situation in the United States follows from the little history I just gave. Fascism is usually the response of the big business community to the perceived threat coming from its victims, namely masses of unemployed people like you had in the 1930s, angry, bitter, and determined trade unions trying to do something for all these unemployed families, socialists and communists who were everywhere spreading the idea that the problem wasn't just you didn't have a job, it was the problem of an entire economic system that gave all the wealth and power to a small number of very rich folks and putting everybody else in jeopardy. Fascism was the answer to that kind of a threat. We don't have fascism in the United States yet, and to be crude about it, the reason is we don't need it yet. We don't have a strong push against big business in this country the way we did in the 1930s. The Communist Party barely exists in the United States, has no political influence that amounts to anything. The same is true of the socialist parties. They exist, but their influence is minuscule. And the labor movement in America has been declining in its importance for 50 years. And just to give you one statistic, the percentage of private employees, the private sector is a major part of the American economy, private enterprises. If you add up all the workers in private enterprises, 6.3% of them are either members of unions or represented by a union. The other 93% are not. In other words, you have a tiny minority of people in unions, so the unions are weaker than they've been at any time in 50 years. So with a virtually disappeared communist and socialist part of the population, at least in any organized way, and the decline of unions, you don't need fascism in America because you don't have the mass uprising to repress. But the reason I would hesitate to say we don't have any of it is that we are right now, literally as you and I are speaking, we are living through a period of time where the American people are beginning to wake up to the situation and are beginning to get angry. The Occupy Wall Street movement was a clear sign of that. the amazing support for Bernie Sanders, despite all the things that were done to squash his efforts. There's another sign of that. Black Lives Matter as a movement beginning to question the economics in our society. All of these and many more that I don't have time to list are signs of change and signs of rising criticism of capitalism. Even the response to my own economic update radio and television show is beyond anything any of us had imagined possible as little as 3 or 4 years ago in terms of the interest and the support. So I would say we don't have it yet, but we will be increasingly seeing signs of it, like Charlottesville, like that attempted march in Berkeley, California that never quite came off a few weeks after that. We'll see the signs of people beginning to move in the direction of fascism, offering themselves up as the stormtroopers of the future to big business, so that as big business sees the left beginning to emerge, we will also see the fascistic response that you had in the 1930s resurface here.
So since like Germany and what people look at as that period of fascism, writers like Sheldon Wolin in 2003 have described what happens here as a type of totalitarianism that's different but has kind of fascist tendencies. So he talked about inverted totalitarianism, where it may not be that kind of signature fascism as like the government is thug, but how resources and everything is commodified and we live in a very consumer-based culture that kind of like lulls the citizenry into a different type of behavior. That, you know, we may not have boots on our neck, but the society is organized in a way that still gives corporations the upper hand in everything. And so in so many parts of our lives and increasingly in government functions like prisons and education and certainly the military at this point, but in so many spaces that used to be the commons.
Yeah, let me respond. I think it is very well taken. Your points are right on target. Maybe the way I should say it is a little bit different. That we don't need the boots on our neck, as you put it, kind of fascism. But meanwhile, the other side of the coin of having no left wing that threatens big business into having fascism is that the absence of a left wing, the absence of a powerful alliance between the labor movement on the one hand and social progressive mass organizations on the other, is that big business can do almost anything it wants without having to have thugs yet. And so you see that they're using their money, basically. They're buying the political system. They're buying both of the political parties. They make it impossible to run for office without raising millions of dollars. And they're the only ones, basically, who can provide those millions in most cases. Bernie Sanders showed that you could raise a lot of money from small donations, from small people. And that's a sign of the future, too. But I think you're right that the big business is able to take advantage of no opposition effectively from the left, from the labor movement, and move in and make everything a profit-making operation for them. Have the government, for example, basically atrophy the post office so that we all increasingly have to rely on UPS or FedEx or any of the other private substitutes that what the government used to do more cheaply and better for most of us is now being done by a private enterprise whose first objective is to make money off of it. And so we live in this kind of increasingly corporate-dominated bundle. And, you know, the Trump administration literally takes away what little facade there had been before and simply turns the government over to big bankers and big industrialists and all the rest. So you can see in an almost daily way that we don't yet need the thug type of corporate dominance. That's fascism. We have the soft version where the corporations, having undone their critics, the left, the labor movement, for 50 years, is now free to indulge every excess of wealth, every excess of power that they can imagine, because it, so far they haven't yet generated the opposition. So we'll see in the years ahead whether this kind of soft corporate dominance gives way to a much harder and uglier. And I think, again, that the beginnings of the kinds of folks who did their thing there in Charlottesville is the sign that those right-wing forces that usually come forward offering themselves as the thugs to the people in charge, in case you need some thugs, here we are, that we're going to see more of that in direct proportion, that those businesses at the top feel the need of having groups like that as a counterweight against an emerging left-wing alternative.
So I know you have done a lot of work in terms of the development of worker co-ops to kind of address the idea of who should benefit from work and workers actually owning the business and owning their work and owning the profits of their labor. So I know it's kind of shifting gears a little bit, but as I wind down, I want to know, how can people, when they look at this issue of fascism, be sure that new emerging models that people are creating won't also become bastions of white supremacy? I was actually rereading A People's History of the United States by Howard Zinn. There was the development of these cooperatives, farmer cooperatives in like Texas and different places in the 1800s. And one of the men, I was trying to find his name, you know, some of these cooperatives became very exclusive and, you know, very, you know, they were filled with racists, you know, and they didn't want to share that same type of cooperative spirit to other black people. They just wanted to keep it among themselves. So, you know, how do we, as we try to evolve and create other models to avoid going down the road of fascism, how do we keep new organizations and new models?
No, I understand your question. These are things that I think it would be naive not to expect, but I think if we expect them, then we will plan for them, and then we will be prepared with the arguments and the mobilized people to not let that kind of thing happen. And as a concluding comment, let me tell you one of the places here in America where the worker co-op as a new model of economic development is at its most exciting space, and that's in Jackson, Mississippi, where the Lumumba group, the people who won the elections there in that city, have indicated and shown us that they are committed to basically say 150 years of capitalism, America has left Mississippi, one of the poorest states in the country, left behind in many, many ways. It's not a successful economic system for the people of Mississippi, white and black, but particularly the African Americans. And we're going to go in a different direction. We're going to try to build an economy that's good for the people of our city and our state, but that's based on a democratic, worker-owned and operated enterprise. That's an amazing thing to see in an American state, in an American city, and I like it because it puts African Americans in the forefront. It makes them the leaders, the model creators, the people that the rest of us, white and black and Latino and so on, can learn from and can follow. And that may in the end be one of the most important ways to prevent the regression of a worker co-op movement to something with racist or other unwanted qualities, if we can see that some of the leadership of making this a broad movement in this country comes precisely from the African-American community, which is able to be critical of capitalism because it's gotten such a raw deal from that system for so long.
Okay, so do you have any other final thoughts before we sign off?
No, I just would like to say that having this kind of a conversation on the air is an enormous, great service that you provide to your listeners, and I would just want to congratulate you and the station for being as valuable in this time of change and of questioning, that people ought to take their hats off, that there are folks like you making these kinds of programs to help people think through the situation. We'll all be better off the more we have these opportunities.
Oh, well, thank you. And thank you for joining me this morning. I've been speaking to Richard Wolf, Professor Emeritus at the University of Massachusetts, Amherst, and currently a visiting professor at the New School University in New York City. He is the author of several books, including Capitalism's Crisis Deepens, Essays on the Global Economic Meltdown. He's also co-founder of the social justice organization Democracy at Work. Thank you for joining me, Professor Wolf.
Thank you again, and I hope we'll have a chance to resume the conversation in the future.
Oh, I'm sure we will. Thank you. And that will do it for today's show. I want to thank my guest, Richard Wolf. I'm Esther Averam, giving a special shout out to our newest listeners in Atlanta. Keep raising your voice. Peace.
That's right. What a terrific show. We're very fortunate to have such a great show, and we're very fortunate to have such a great speaker as Richard Wolf. I'm not sure how soft the modern oppression is. If we have a billionaire president who endorses police brutality, and that is a very short step from there to fascism. So we're very fortunate to have this terrific radio station, KBOO Community Radio, and you can pledge your support to make sure people like Richard Wolf do get airtime by picking up the phone and dialing 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-5266. And don't forget, Hitler rose to power on the backs of the brown shirts, the SA, and they were just thugs. They were thugs like the people in Charlottesville. But he got supreme executive power, and that is a terrifying thought. The way you can help prevent it and the way you can stay educated is by listening to KBOO and dialing 877-500-5266. Isn't that right, Liz?
Absolutely. You can also become a member by going online to kboo.fm and becoming a member that way. And however you do it, it doesn't matter, because what matters is your support of your community radio station.
That's right.
It's time for you to invest in your community, and this is how you do it, by keeping these kind of diverse and unique perspectives on the air. Where else are you going to hear Marxist analysis or a fascist analysis of the United States government? You're not going to hear it anywhere else on your radio dial. You may find it online somewhere, but this is locally produced, local radio produced by members of your community. And when you become a member, it's your community too. So it's not like you're just giving money to some charity. You are personally invested, and when you become a member, you can also become a volunteer here. You can learn how to make your own radio. You can learn how to produce radio. You can learn how to be an on-air host. You can work behind the scenes.
You can't get much more local than that.
That's true. It's absolutely true. But it all starts with your phone call, 877-500-5266. We also, for this half hour, have a goal of $180. I'm really happy to report that we did amazingly well with our last half hour's show. We quadrupled our goal.
Way.
Wow! So, you know, I bet we could do that this time, too, if we had... Oh, here, Will. Here, you can... I got a whole bunch of people to ring bells for, so you can be my bell ringer. So, you know, we've got...
I feel like Quasimodo.
We've only got 3 minutes, but I bet we can quadruple that $180 goal for this half hour, too. If you pick up the phone right now, 877-500-5266. I want to say thank you to Ronald from Beaverton.
Thanks, Ron.
Mark from Salem.
Thanks, Mark.
Richard from Southeast Portland.
Thank you, Richard.
Karen from Forest Grove.
Thank you, Karen.
Ron from Monmouth.
Thank you, Ron.
And Jenna from Scappoose.
Thank you, Jenna.
All of those folks renewed their membership to KBOO this morning. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And don't forget, when we ring that bell, a demon gets its horns.
That's right.
So please pledge your support to KBOO by dialing 877-500-5266, like all those lovely people we just mentioned. And we'd especially like to get some new members, some people who are just listening in for the first time and appreciating this great radio station. You can put your money where your passion is. That sounds amazing. bit dodgy. But anyway, call 877-500-5266.
You know, at any given time, we have about 5,500 listeners, but only 500 of those listeners are members. That's a really low ratio. We'd like to make that ratio a little more equitable. Now's the time. 877-500-5266. And when you call today or go online today, we'll enter your name into a special drawing that's only available today. The drawing is to win 12 passes to an hour-long soak and sauna session at Common Ground Wellness Co-op in Portland. This whole drawing is only available today. We're going to have a different drawing for a different prize tomorrow. So if relaxing in a hot tub in a beautiful, quiet place sounds like your cup of tea, pick up that phone right now, 877-500-5266, or online at kboo.fm. It's up to you. We rely on you. So we're not doing this for ourselves here. You are a part of what's happening when you listen, but you can become a contributing and sustaining part of what's happening when you pick up the phone and become a member, renew your membership, gift membership to somebody, or increase your current level of membership. It doesn't matter. We're open to all ideas here. 877-500-5266. That's it for me and Will signing off. Thank you so much, and don't forget to call.
Thank you, everybody who's already called, and thank you for everybody who's going to call. I know you're out there, I know you're listening, and I know you're going to make this wonderful radio station happy.
KBOO would like to give special thanks to our local community partners who have donated food for our volunteers today. Lunch was provided by Daily Cafe, located 902 Northwest 13th Street in Portland, and serving breakfast and lunch daily in the Pearl. Dinner was provided by Dove Vivi, located 2727 Northeast Gleason Street in Portland, open 4 p.m. to 10 p.m. daily and serving cornmeal crust pizza. For more information on how you can support KBOO, call 877-500-5255.